Good morning. If it please the court, Trenton Kashima on behalf of the plaintiff appellants in both the O'Day versus Alchemy and O'Day RB Health Matters. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if possible. As your honors are aware, this is the companion to the previous case that was just heard. And likewise, this case concerns whether plaintiffs may assert state law claims against a pharmaceutical company for manufacturing a BPO-based Acme treatment that has high levels of benzene in it. Now, the differences between this case is in this particular case, we specifically allege that the benzene results from the premature degradation of BPO during the shelf life of these products, and the mechanism of degradation is due to defendants' negligent manufacturing practices. Therefore, plaintiff's action presents a straightforward question: whether the FDCA prohibits the negligent manufacturing of drugs, which results in it becoming contaminated with benzene through its good manufacturing practice regulations, and if so, whether the state law claims asserted below mirror these federal requirements. If the answer to both these questions are yes, there is no preemption. Now, as you previously heard, the text of the relevant preemption clause is clear and has been restated that states can adopt legal requirements not different from or addition to the requirements of the FDCA. And this is at 21 USC.
But does this claim depend on a finding that the FDA sets a 2 ppm limit for this?
I would say no. And Your Honor, there's two different reasons.
But that, just to be clear, that same question was asked below, and I think the answer was that's correct. So that if you want to say, yes, I'm changing this position, and you need to know that, that's fine. But is it a change in position from the district court?
No, that was from page, I think, 20 and 21 of the decision. And if you see, Judge Blumenfeld ellipsed out an important kind of spirited conversation between me and the judge, where I actually just gave the same answer to him that I gave to you. And I'll actually give you the same answer that I gave to him, is our breach of warranty claims, our consumer protection claims, would exist even without the FDCA, because we're claiming what's essentially a breach of implied warranty. And every pharmaceutical standard says that benzene shouldn't be in pharmaceuticals, and if it's absolutely necessary, not above 2 parts per million, and this includes the ICH, the international standards, the FDCA standards, the USP, which is an official compendium under the
Are these binding standards, or are they advisory?
The FDA standards through the Q3C and the ICH standards, which are international standards, so not binding in the U.S., are advisory. But it's our position that the USP standards are actually binding. And I think I was just about to touch on that, is the FDCA basically adopts industry standards through the FDCA. And how it does so is in 21 USC 321 J, it states that the USP is actually official compendium. Now, if we go to the adulteration statute, which is 21 USC 351 B, it also states that failure to comply with these official compendiums, specifically failure to not meet the standards of the official compendiums regarding purity and quality, would render a drug adulterated unless two things happen. The FDA sets a different standard. Our defendants specifically disclose that they're using a different standard other than the USP. And this makes sense, because people would assume that if they're taking a drug, that drug meets the uniform standard for drugs in the United States set by the pharmaceutical
industry.
Do
these standards cover this degradation theory, or are they about, you know, when you're using something in the manufacture of the product? Or is that not a distinction that you find helpful?
Actually, both. And I think this is where the recent decision in Navarro versus Walmart. We have a case against Walgreens, too. It is particularly helpful, because Judge Boone below, I think, is the first judge to actually go through the language of the FDCA and USP ad nauseum. And he even notes that under the language of both the FDCA and the USP, it covers degraded substances, such as BPO degrading into benzene. And also the USP, both in its general chapter 467, which covers residual solvents such as benzene, it specifically states that that benzene can be used in the manufacturing or resulting from the manufacturing of pharmaceuticals. So it covers both ingredients used in the production of pharmaceuticals as well as ingredients produced as a byproduct of pharmaceuticals. And we also know that this is the position of the FDA. The FDA in December 2023 actually issued an alert to manufacturers regarding the risks of benzene, specifically calling out BPO products, noting that benzene can result from the degradation of BPO products, particularly in high temperatures, and manufacturers should take care to ensure under cGMP regulations that that doesn't happen. And they noted that they should do stability testing and finished product testing to ensure nothing goes out of the shelf with more than 2 parts per million of benzene. And so we're not trying to hold the defendants in these matters to some standard not articulated or and not thought of under the FDCA, not adopted by the FDA. We're holding them to a federal standard, but we're doing so through state law. State laws that have existed well before the FDCA and the cGMP regulations, which weren't enacted.
Counsel, why doesn't this run under the district court's theory that you are usurping the FDA's prerogative to enforce its own rules?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the FDA has already stated what its rule is, and it's this 2 parts per million rule through its guidance. And it also, the USP establishes a 2 parts per million rule under the FDCA. So we're not saying that we're overtaking the FDCA's prerogative. We're matching what the FDA has said.
Right, but there's two different things. One is the prerogative to set the standard, and, mm-hmm. and there I think that your argument is coextensive with what the FDA has done. I think it's mm-hmm. consistent with what the FDA has done. But there's a different provision that says that the FDA is charged with the enforcement of these standards. Now, why aren't you usurping that prerogative? The FDA has taken a little bit of a go slow proposition here. It's noted the problem. It has a petition before it. It's disputed the third party labs. And we know that the FDA doesn't move very quickly on just about anything. So, but why isn't this the FDA's prerogative to decide to address the benzene problem or not?
Your Honor, that is true. There is the value share position that's before the FDA, and you're right. The FDA hasn't moved on it, and I think it's been about 4 years, and there's no evidence that they're intending to move on it. There's no public comment period. There's nothing there. But I think this goes back to something that you actually said in the previous case, is Looper Bright Enterprises made it particularly clear that it is the court's job to interpret statutes. And the statute that we have here states under 21 U.S.C. 351A and B, which deals with the cGMP violations, and A deals with decomposed substances, that these products are adulterated. And what that means is a question of interpretation for a court. Even if the FDA was to bring an enforcement action here, regarding benzene, they would still have to come to the court. So whether it's a private litigant litigating a case involving an FDA standard, or the FDA enforcing its own standards, what the statute means and whether there's a statutory violation is often a question that's going to have to be determined by court adjudication.
Well, what is the allegation as to the defect in the manufacturing process, I guess? What do you claim went wrong in that process?
Three different things went wrong, Your Honor. First is we state that they didn't hold or manufacture the product under suitable environmental regulations as required under 211.84. So basically that they held and manufactured these products and likely transported these products too in high temperatures. And this was compounded by the fact that they didn't do finished product testing or the type of stability testing required, specifically the FDCA says is required under the 2023 alert to find this degradation before it hit the shelf. And we support that allegation by specifically citing additional study, not just the Valisher study, but study the evaluation of presence of benzene and the formation of benzyl peroxide drugs cited in the Journal of Investigative Dermatology. And this can be found on 22 of our opening brief. And this particular study found that under in 111 products, BPO products tested, about 34 of them off the shelf before any stability testing was done had benzyl peroxide, including defendant's products. And so this suggests...
Had benzene or benzyl peroxide?
Sorry, benzene.
Okay.
There's too many B chemicals at issue here. But as your honor can see, if it's coming off the shelf, already adulterated with high levels of benzene, then that points to the fact that there's probably some problem in manufacturing. This isn't happening in someone's bathroom. This isn't happening in someone's car. This is happening off the shelf. And that's how we support our position here. That's the negligent manufacturing of these drugs. And I think this goes back to a point.
But is this just a supposition that, you know, because we have benzene in it later and because it was manufactured, something must have happened in the manufacturing process? Or is actually any more specific theory is on this point?
Your Honor, there is
facts pled.
I've done a few of these cases, so I know what likely is, but this is kind of the issue, and Ninth Circuit law has stated this. When the facts are all in defendant's hands and their manufacturing process isn't something that's publicly known, we can't really offer evidence of what exactly went wrong. We can't say, well, they held it in an unconditioned room at this facility. They transported the BPO from the manufacturer in unrefrigerated boxcars. That's what we've seen in past cases.
Right, but isn't that the essence of a manufacturing defect theory? You got to show what the manufacturing defect actually was.
Yes, and the manufacturing defect here is there's benzene in the products.
How that happened. What happened that you think caused it?
I specifically think that there was a lack of temperature control in the manufacturing.
Yeah, but you don't allege that, right?
We know that pretty well, and this is the reason we do. There's really only two mechanisms that BPO develops into these products. Is one, it's added, or two, it is produced prematurely due to high heat. And as was mentioned by my learned friend...
Your theory is we found it, therefore there must be high heat.
No, Your Honor. And so... Not only did we find it through stability testing and we found it off the shelf, but the amounts are critical here because we're talking not just 2 parts per million. With the Valisher testing, I think it was in the hundreds, if not thousands, parts per million, suggesting that the degradation had been ongoing and constant since the manufacturing of the product. And the same thing happened in the Journal of Investigative Dermatology findings. And so that's what we're using to support it. And unfortunately, without an eye into the manufacturing process, all we can do is look at these the testing that we have available and make educated guesses on what happens. And under both Rule 8 and Rule 9, that is sufficient because we're not expected to produce evidence at the time of pleading. We're not expected to produce evidence specifically that's only in defendant's hands at the time of pleading.
So, counsel, before you sit down, I do want to take you back to the to 337A, and that is the provision that gives FDA the right to enforce its own rules. So why aren't you impliedly preempted under that provision? Seems to be reinforced by 337B, which specifically says the states can enforce some of these things, but they have to give notice to the FDA. That doesn't feel like that's what happens when we have a tort suit.
Your Honor, I think what's interesting here is the progression of the implied preemption law is far from clear, particularly from this circuit recently. However, you see that the claims, the preemptive claims and unpreemptive claims seem to fall into two predictable categories. If you look at cases like Buckman, where there was fraud in the FDA in securing approval of bone screws, or Perez, where it was off-label use, whether it was off-label use of an eye laser, or Nexus, where it was whether this particular compounding pharmacy needed to gain FDA approval before offering a particular drug. all those cases involve areas that fall out of traditional state law claims. And so areas where it only involves the FDA's discretion to approve drugs or the FDA's prerogative that finds no analog in state cases because the states don't approve drugs. But if you look at cases like...
But wouldn't that be answered then by 337B? 337B says that if the states wish to do this, so if they, for some reason the FDA was unwilling to do so because it thought that it was within what the states ordinarily would enforce, again, the states must bring it in their own name and give the FDA notice. Now, that's not your case. You're doing this indirectly through the tort mechanism, and it's still state action, but it's not in the name of the state.
Yes, and I think this was particularly handled by the Davidson case that was recently decided by the Ninth Circuit. And so it walked through Section 337 the implied preemption claims and notes that under 375R, or at least an analogous clause in the FDCA that has the same language, not identical to R in addition, in these situations, there's no evidence that that Congress specifically wanted to ensure that there was no remedy for private litigants. That private litigants.
Well, other than the fact that it said that the FDA has charged with this, and if the states do it, they must bring it in their own name and give the FDA notice. Other than that, you might be correct. Seems like a pretty big exception.
Your Honor, you know, what's interesting about that is there, I think this is what causes a lot of courts this issue with these implied preemption claims is because you have one section of the FDCA, the express preemption clause, where we have to look at because express preemption, we're looking at our preemption claims in general, we're looking at the intent of Congress. And here Congress made it clear that they're not trying to occupy the field and that they're leaving open state claims, as long as they didn't...
As long as they bring it in their own name. This suit has not been brought in the name of California.
No, it hasn't, Your Honor. And so, but the breadth of case law from this circuit has stated that plaintiffs can bring private claims that sound in the FDCA as long as they're based on parallel state requirements. And here it is. We're not bringing a claim for violation of FDCA. We're bringing a claim of violation, for example, of the Sherman Law in California or breach of implied warranty because, obviously, something is not merchantable if it's not able to be sold and it contains benzene, which pretty much every pharmaceutical regulator has said and every pharmaceutical industry has said is – renders a product adulterated due to its high level of toxicity.
On this, is this dependent on there being a 2 ppm, or is there some claim independent of that?
I know I'm bringing this back to your first question. And so, again, because we're bringing it under state law standards, I don't believe that it is that there is a requirement for 2 ppm for two reasons.
But so why did you say that to the district court? He asked you. The district judge asked you that precise question, and you said, yes, Your Honor, our claim is dependent. And then you went on to say, well, there's some exceptions, and I think our case still survives. But you said that exactly.
So actually, if we look at ER 036 and 037 of the record.
Yeah, I have been. that's exactly what I'm looking at.
Particularly 036 at starting at line number 13, I specifically say I believe the warranty claims would proceed even if there is no federal guidelines on what benzene levels are.
Oh, no, I know that's what you said, but you know, Judge Brass asked you the question, does it depend? You said no, and the same question by the district court, and you said yes. Now, I get your explanation of why you think it's not fatal. Mm. But I'm puzzled.
And, Your Honor, I think, again, this was during a very spirited debate at the lower level. And so...
And your argument, I take it, does depend on a finding by the court that the FDA has set a 2 part per million limit. That's correct, Your Honor. That's what you said.
Sorry, Your Honor, which line are you at?
Now, let's see. Yeah, between lines 3 and 5.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think this is, you know, my answer was.
Then you went on to say, but I still think the claim survives.
Yeah, and so, Your Honor, I think I qualified that one.
But,
sorry,
you know, when you tell Judge Press no, and you tell a district court yes, I'm confused.
No, Your Honor. And so to the extent that was not my intention at the lower court, and I think you can see that because after that particular sentence, there is, I think, a page and a half of me saying that, no, we'd still have the implied warranty claims because we'd still be able to use, you know, industry standards to enforce those, that even without the 2 parts per million, you know, whether the FDA, I think the court below said, likes it or not, we'd still be able to move forward. And so I do think I clarified that response. I'm trying to give Your Honors the same response.
Yeah, but the district court, I mean, he quoted some of the same exchanges in the actual order. And was there a motion for reconsideration filed with the district court?
No, Your Honor. Okay.
Well, then what do you make of the fact that the the agency says this is only for guidance? On the 2 parts per million.
I believe what you're referring to is the Q3C list. And the QC3 list has an interesting history because it's basically the FDA is part of the ICH. So they work together to basically harmonize international standards on drugs for cross-border trade. And so that list and the ICH list are kind of coexisting. But even beyond those lists, the USP, which creates drug standards for the United States and for pharmaceutical companies within the United States, has adopted that same language.
Was this brought before the district court, the USP?
No, it wasn't, Your Honor. It was mentioned briefly in our complaint when we were talking about warning letters sent to other manufacturers, such as Johnson & Johnson. We mentioned.
But how is this properly before us if it wasn't put to the district court?
Your Honor, this is a relatively new argument, I'll admit, and it's one that has recently come up due to opinions like Navarro that have specifically set this out for the first time. And so I think Navarro is actually the first time that this argument was made below to a district court and there's been a decision on it. And that's where the argument comes
from. So before the district court, you were relying on the Q3C tables, correct?
We're relying on the QC3 tables, the...
So let me interrupt, sorry. Here's my question for you. Under the QC3 tables, here's what they say. In general, FDA's guidance documents do not establish legally enforceable responsibilities. Instead, guidances describe agencies' current thinking on a topic and should be viewed only as a recommendation, and goes on for that. So why do you say it's a requirement?
Your Honor, like I said, I believe that document and the ICH documents are guidance. They don't have any legally binding authority. It's only the USP. But I would still fall back on the arguments made by my learned friend and myself that even absent the USP, there is a catch-all. And this was specifically designed into the FDCA, the catch-all for all filthy, putrid, and decomposed substances found at 21 USC 351A, to ensure that even if it wasn't listed on some list, even if there was no regulatory action, that that the FDA or private litigants and state actions can still bring a claim for adulterants. Because as was recognized in the Sandoz case, which is cited in our brief, is the FDA can't list every adulterant. There's just way too many drugs, way too many adulterants, and the list of drugs changes from year to year. And so that's what this catch-all claim exists.
Okay, we've let you go. Yeah, we've given you some bonus time here, but let me see, are there other questions now? Okay, so we'll put 3 minutes on the clock for rebuttal. We look forward to seeing you shortly.
Thank you.
We'll hear from your opposing counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning again. May it please the court, David Zients on behalf of the defendants. I'd like to start with what this court has said a number of times, which is there's a narrow gap And sometimes that's a gap that can't be navigated between express preemption on the one hand, where you need something that parallels federal law, but on the other hand, for the reasons that Judge Bybee was pointing to in Section 337 A and B, you have the statutory bar on private enforcement that says you can't just be suing only to enforce a regulation of the FDA. And the plaintiffs here can't navigate through that. So let me start with express preemption. In particular, you know, the way they tried to solve that problem was with this 2 ppm limit that they imposed. And so I don't want to belabor the colloquy here about, I mean, we can all read the transcript. I think, you know, Judge Brest, the answer you heard this morning was just not the answer that was given to Judge Blumenfeld in the district court. What I will say is, even if I spot them for the sake of argument that there was this caveat about a warranty theory, what my friend says is, well, we have this warranty theory, and we could be relying on international guidance. Okay, what I have, if that was their theory for how they get around that concession in the district court, what I would have expected to see in their briefs or at argument is, okay, if you have a warranty theory that says you are not adhering to international guidance, how is that parallel to a federal requirement? And you don't have an argument. So, if the court finds that that piece of it was sort of saved from the concession, I don't think that really changes anything, because they have a very big express preemption problem. For everything else, I do think there's a reason why they said that. And it wasn't just, 36 to 37 of the ER. This wasn't a gotcha with Judge Blumenfeld. This was, over sequential pleadings, hearings. I'll give you two examples. At SER 51, this was when plaintiffs were asking for leave to try again, to explain what they would do. They say, we adopt the same standards adopted under the FDCA and its regulations, 2 parts per million. That's the number we have to show is exceeded in order to have a cause of action. That's before, Judge Blumenfeld finally pinned them down at the final hearing. Then again, ER 495 in the operative complaint, the presence of benzene above 2 ppm renders the products adulterated under the FDCA. That is a statement from them that their case is about law, federal law, that says there's a 2 ppm limit. So whether you just go off of that last, very last colloquy or everything else, there's a reason that they said that, because they need to find something that is parallel. They landed on 2 ppm. The problem, as has come through in the questions, and I think my friend actually admitted it at the end, it is not binding. The Q3C, which is the source of that guidance that they relied on in the district court, says on its face, when we say should, that means a recommendation, a suggestion. It is not a requirement. So again, going back to the preemption law that we're talking about here, it asks for a comparison of requirements. FDA says this is guidance. When we say should, it's not a requirement. The additional problem, I think that's more than enough to stop. The additional problem is the guidance itself is not talking about this sort of product-specific question of degradation and what you need to do about a product like benzoyl peroxide that at certain temperatures has this potential to degrade. The guidance talks about use in the manufacturer of the drug. So it is sort of doubly unhelpful to them. It is not binding and is also not applicable or relevant. The USP, again, I think we got an admission. The fact that a district court later, had this idea and thought it was relevant, I don't think that excuses their waiver, the admitted waiver, that they didn't raise this USP argument in the district court. But I will say, if the court wants to reach that issue, it's the same. It reads the same way. It is not fundamentally different in any way. It says should. So I don't think you can have a theory that says the adulteration statute says you look to the compendium, compendium says you should do something, and then conclude that it is a requirement of federal law that you have to do it. And again, I think that the compendium is also talking about use in the manufacture and production, not this degradation issue.
So recognizing the role of the FDA, is there an avenue for a plaintiff to make a manufacturing-based theory of adulteration or misbranding?
Sure. Well, one avenue that Congress clearly left open is a product liability case. So again, to go back to what we were talking about earlier this morning, a key feature of this case that governs which set of rules applies is the fact that no one claims they were hurt. If someone is hurt by a product, where the manufacturing went wrong. At that point, they don't have to worry about, you know, coming up with a 2 ppm limit. They can say, you know, there's a traditional state tort of a manufacturing defect and try to argue that there's no issue, you know, there. I think if someone were actually hurt, you would have a very different case. Because
if someone were actually hurt, you agree that if the plaintiffs could show there was excessive heat used in the manufacturing process as a viable theory.
Your Honor, I think if you had a product liability case and you had, you know, totally not purporting to enforce an FDA regulation, but there was some state law duty to not use this type of excessive heat because that's unreasonable, et cetera, and that wasn't in conflict with anything from federal law, I think, I don't want to, you know, stipulate to something that I don't know all the facts of, but that's a very different case.
Is there heat used in the manufacturing process?
Is there heat used?
Yeah.
You know, I can only go off of the complaint here, and I don't know the answer to every. Again, I think one of the questions was raised before. You know, aren't there different manufacturers here? I'm here speaking on behalf of.
I'm just talking about your client.
Yeah, the truth is
you
your answer. I think my client has serious manufacturing controls and takes these obligations seriously. And you know, fundamentally, it's the FDA that enforces these things.
I understand.
Is an
I'm
issue.
Just asking.
Yeah, I think you know, and but I think
on the record.
Sure, but to go back to the
but,
record.
But his point is, he needs discovery to find out.
Well, Your Honor,
you can't tell me whether it's going to yield anything. It's just standard.
Sure, Your Honor. What I don't think you can do is say, you know. Is infer backwards from the end result a manufacturing violation, the sort of res ipsa loquitur. I know that because something bad happened, there was a violation. These regulations are about process. You could follow all the right processes in the world and something goes wrong. Conversely, you could do an incredibly shoddy job. I'm not saying any of the defendants here did that, but someone could do a really shoddy job with their controls and luck out and nothing bad happens. They still had a manufacturing violation. This court in the Weber case said, I mean, that was at a summary judgment stage, but I think the principle applies, which was the evidence there was that something had gone wrong, but we can't infer from that there was a manufacturing violation. Here, there's no evidence, but there's an allegation that something went wrong, 2 ppm. So I don't think under that you can just infer that there must have been a manufacturing violation. Even setting all of that aside, you know, we talked about the 2 ppm. I think that is maybe the simplest disposition here. They tied their case to 2 ppm, and it doesn't exist. But there is, you know, on the sort of the other side of the narrow gap, is the statute that Judge Bybee was talking about before. You know, implied preemption as a result of the statutory bar on private enforcement. And there is a long line of cases from this court. You know, Perez, Nexus, a recent unpublished disposition in Buback that says if you are suing, if the point of the litigation is you don't have a cause of action unless you prove a violation of the FDCA or its regulations, you are out of court because then you are standing in the shoes of the FDA or under a state proceeding in its own name, and Congress decided that shouldn't happen. So we heard over and over this morning, FDCA, CGMPs, federal regulations, their theory, again, this isn't it happens to be the case that there is some state duty that they think is parallel to the CGMPs. What they say, you know, the misbranding theory is you know, we falsely implied compliance with the CGMPs. That is identical to what was, you know, materially identical to what was alleged in Nexus in Perez, where it was a sort of false implication that the product was FDA approved and lawful to be sold. The unfair trade practice claim here is it is adulterated because it violates the federal CGMPs. That is suing not to enforce a state law that happens to parallel federal law. It is suing to enforce federal law. You know, what the court said in Nexus, that if you had that theory, it would amount to litigation of the alleged underlying FDCA violation, and that is what Congress reserved for in the first instance, the United States, and in certain, you know, appropriate circumstances to a state proceeding in its own name. So this, I don't see the distinction between those cases and this one. I do want to address the Davidson case that my friend raised, the sort of suggesting that all that is out the window, and now this circuit follows an entirely different set of principles. I think that is not true. It, you know, one good indication of that is the Buback decision, where a panel looked at all of these holistically after Davidson and sort of recognized that the basic principles from Nexus and Perez still apply. I also think, and I will be candid, I think that Judge Collins had the better of it in the dissent, and Judge Callahan agreed when she separately opined on this, that it is tough to reconcile some of the things in the Davidson majority with pre-existing circuit case law. But I do think it can be harmonized, and I think the best way to do that is you understand Davidson as being very specific to the federal food labeling context, and a very specific provision that the court pointed to under the California Sherman Law. And it wasn't just a sort of generic, the California Sherman Law parallels at a high level, the federal standards. The court in Davidson pointed to a provision of the Sherman Law that expressly adopted, it says, every regulation of food labeling adopted by the FDA is adopted as a regulation of this state. So that's where you had this construct that the Davidson majority found persuasive, that really this was enforcing the Sherman Law that just happened to parallel and be alongside the FDCA. Whether you agree with that or with Judge Collins in the dissent, that is not the theory here. The plaintiffs have not pointed to anything that says every last federal good manufacturing practice regulation is hereby adopted in the law of California, in the law of Illinois, in the law of Missouri. Some of the states like Missouri that they rely on has sort of nothing like that at all. They point to Illinois and California, which at a general level, mirrors the high-level adulteration standard and mentions, good manufacturing practice. It doesn't do what Davidson had, which is it said every single last regulation in the federal rule book is hereby adopted as a regulation of the state. And I think that is a perfectly reasonable way of treating Davidson so as not to kind of, upend, the longstanding circuit precedent here. A couple other quick points to make. There was a comment, the FDA moves slow. It is true that in this case, the FDA, has not proceeded, rapidly on the citizen petition. FDA absolutely can move fast when it wants to. There is a provision in the law for very expedited action when FDA, thinks that there is a serious health risk. So again, if there was a serious health problem and people were being hurt, one, you have the product liability exception. Two, you have a mechanism by which FDA can act quickly. And then three, the other thing I would say, I made the point in the first argument this morning, I think it applies equally here. The reason that Congress enacted the statutory bar on private enforcement is that FDA has to balance a lot of things, and it is taking a different approach from what any of the plaintiffs here would prefer. We've talked about a recall, much more limited than what any of the plaintiffs here are asking for. Even some of the defendants in this case, including RB Health, who I represent, was not subject to the recall. There's other defendants who very specific lots. It was just on a lot-specific basis that there was a voluntary recall. And you don't have any allegation from these plaintiffs. It was in this lot and it was the other lot. These are they want to have much more sweeping claims. So I think the idea that the FDA moves slowly under this statutory scheme that Congress enacted, that shows the system working. That, if someone has a problem with FDA, they can sue the FDA for, Valisher can say, unreasonable delay under the APA for acting on the citizen petition. The Supreme Court in Durnell talked about all of the ways, all the mechanisms that you have to bring new information to the agency and even to try to compel an agency to act when it is dragging its feet. State tort law is not the answer. Congress made that very clear, both in the express preemption provision and in the statutory bar on private enforcement. The last point I wanted to respond to, I heard a reference to Loper-Bright, that the court could sort of just interpret adulteration for itself, and I just wanted to note, again, I have not heard a word from my friends about the Monsanto versus Durnell case, which is highly relevant to both of these appeals. In Monsanto versus Durnell, that Loper-Bright argument was made about misbranding, and the court had very little trouble brushing that aside and finding that totally irrelevant and not displacing in that case, the EPA's very important role in giving meaning to this high-level standard of misbranding. Exactly the same is true here about adulteration. And again, this is why we have enforcement discretion, FDA proceeding stepwise, going carefully, and Congress decided that it would disrupt that in a case like this if you had private state tort litigation. Unless there's other questions, Your Honors, we would ask that the decision be affirmed.
Okay. Mr. Zients, thank you.
Your Honors, I'd just like to go through a couple of points that were previously made. One of the things that my colleague mentioned is that the FDA is taking a different approach. But if it is, it's hard to see what that different approach is. Under the
Then isn't your remedy with the FDA? I mean, if you're unhappy that the FDA is not moving at all, or if it's not moving quickly enough, your remedy is with the FDA.
Your Honor,
unless you bring it under 377B, which would be a state action. Which
yes, Your Honor. But the thing is the FDA has already spoken here, even after that Valisher petition. The updated alert that we were talking about before that came out in December 2023 restated the FDA's position with particular clarity that it applies specifically to these products, that they should be recalled if there's 2 parts per million, and failure to abide by that 2 parts per million can render the products adulterated. Not only that, but the likely avenue of this adulteration is high temperatures in the manufacturing processes that could be controlled by cGMP. So there's no injury to the uniform standard being set under the FDCA, because all plaintiffs are doing is arguing the same position that has been adopted by the FDA itself in enforcing its own regulations. Now, I think this brings us to a kind of important point here. I think most of the confusion argument below came from the fact that this idea that silence, if there's silence on a subject in the regulations, then that therefore equals preemption. But that's not the case. This court in ASEANA specifically stated that silence on a particular subject is not the FDA's acquiescence on that subject. Indeed, you can imagine the absurd results, and the Ninth Circuit in that case even mentioned the absurd results that could follow, because if there wasn't a specific regulation on something, then it means that manufacturers could do anything they want in that area. The same is true here. If there is no regulation on the amount of rat poison you can put in pharmaceuticals, basically defendant's position is you can put as much as you want, and we know that's not the case. The next point I just want to quickly address is that manufacturing defect cases have been allowed under similar statutes. As a matter of fact, if we go back to the Medtronic case, Justice Stevens specifically said that there's no harm in allowing these type of negligent manufacturing cases going forward that adopt the FDA's duties. Because it's akin to a state law claim saying that a manufacturer, like a home manufacturer, has to follow building code. It does no injury to the state government's ability to regulate in that area. And the final thing I would mention is there was mention about the Monsanto case, and that is distinguishable. This was noted in the recent case that we just gave a supplemental authority to. But the Monsanto case was under the insecticide, pesticide, and
rodenticide?
Yes. Always forget that
one. My favorite words.
Yeah. And in that particular case, the FDA had to approve every warning that went on the label. Put differently, the EPA required pre-approval. The FDA doesn't have the same requirement under the FDCA as was stated by my learned friend. So they're just not on equal footing. It makes sense there because, again, you are treading on the purview of the FDA because they have to pre-approve these statements. The same is not true here. Thank you, Your Honor. If there's no further questions, I'd submit.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kashima. Thanks to all counsel for the helpful briefing and arguments. This matter is submitted. That concludes our calendar for this morning.